Stuart Goldberg from the John Thor Cancer Center in Hackensack, New Jersey, and I'm here with ManagingMDS.com. As you know, over the last 20 years, we've had an evolution in the management of patients with myelodysplasia. We used to spend most of our time looking at the microscope and making our diagnosis from that, and really then had to make a decision based on how many blasts. But in 1997, the International Prognostic Scoring System was developed, which was a major breakthrough in helping us decide the therapy. I'm honored to be joined by Dr. Peter Greenberg from Stanford University, who is one of the principal authors of the IPSS and also one of the authors of the new revision. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Well, can you tell us a little about the evolution of how IPSS was developed and maybe bring our readers up to speed on what's new in prognostic markers and prognosticating patients with MDS so that we can effectively treat our patients?
There were a large number of scoring systems that were developed to try to determine how best to assess prognosis in MDS. And as a result, we decided to get all the players in the same room, come up with a consensus system, which we did, which has been useful, as you say, since 1997. One of the things that we needed to do was to determine which features were most practical and most useful. It turned out that those features were the blood counts, bone marrow blasts, and chromosomes, used together rather than separately. In addition, age, transfusion use was also important, as were comorbidities. And so as a result, the prognostic scoring system of the IPSS was developed and generated four levels, two of which were lower risk, the upper was higher risk. Subsequently, over the 10 to 15 years following that, newer systems were developed, and the IPSS-R, or the revised IPSS, and the WPSS developed for us to more refine these analyses. As you can see in this slide, there are ways of evaluating the proportion of blasts and making morphologic classifications based on initially the WHO classification, and also those accepted by the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. In general, the proportion of blasts are quite important, and those that are less than 5 to 9% are generally in the lower category of risk. Those in the greater than 10% are in the higher category of risk. One issue of debate is whether acute myeloid leukemia is classified at 20% blasts or 30% blasts. WHO considers that 20, the NCCN considers that 30, because the prior RABE-T classification used by the FAB group seemed to be more akin to MDS than AML. And as a result, this classification provides clinicians the ability to treat those patients either as MDS or AML. This just shows you the scoring system for the IPSS, marrow blast, karyotype, and cytopenias. It generated a variety of outcomes, but most important were cytogenetics, in which there were good, intermediate, and poor risk features. Those in blue are good risk, those in red are poor risk, and the yellow are intermediate. However, because there were a large number of these individuals that had what's considered miscellaneous single abnormalities, many of those could not be used to classify patients. Now, subsequently, and this just shows you the FAB classification, but subsequently it was felt that these other features needed to be better used and evaluated. And so another consensus system was developed as a result of a coalescence of databases from 11 countries using 7,000 patients from the countries that you see here. Most important were the cytogenetics, which now as opposed to the prior six, that had 16 separate groupings that were capable of assessing prognosis. And those were put into five rather than three categories, as you can see here, from very good to very poor prognostic features.
Peter, can I ask you on the cytogenetics? Some physicians tend not to do bone marrows and will do a FISH study for chromosomes. Are all of these cytogenetics able to be picked up on FISH, or do we still need to do classical karyotyping in our patients with MDS?
FISH categorization usually depends on the number of probes that are used, and generally only five are used. And those are some of the major abnormalities, such as 5q-, 7, 8, 20, and 21. But as you can see, there are many more cytogenetic abnormalities that can occur. So FISH abnormality alone is not adequate to relatively well characterize patients, number one. And number two, if you have good standard karyotyping, FISH is unnecessary because it just replicates in general what you have found by standard karyotyping.
If you find a normal chromosome and then you are one of those, maybe the karyotype didn't come out well and the FISH is abnormal, would you put the FISH score into the IPSS or do you use the classical karyotype?
So long as you have adequate standard karyotyping, that is with 20 metaphases, that should be fine. In the situation where there is inadequate numbers of karyotypes, then one can consider the FISH, but with the understanding that it is suboptimal. And this just shows that there are different scores for the cytogenetic groupings, percentage of blasts, and the depth of the cytopenias. The depth of the cytopenias were important, not just whether the patient had low blood counts. And when one put that together, we now have five as opposed to four categories of risk from very low to very high, with median survivals ranging from 8.8 to 0.8 years. And similarly, a different proportion of patients at risk for acute myeloid leukemia evolution. So the IPSSR had predictive features for disease status, which was an improvement over the prior IPSS, in which it demonstrated that blasts greater or less than 10% were very important. The specific cytogenetic subgroups now were much more precise. The depth of cytopenias were critical. Age was also important, as were other predictors such as performance status and certain serum tests such as ferritin and LDH. Although beyond bone marrow blasts, cytogenetics, and depth of cytopenias, these other features were relatively minor.
For some of the people who are not used to the IPSR, I think the new depth of abnormal blood counts is a change, obviously, between the IPSS and the IPSSR. I know I've always, you know, played the count of 90,000 gotcha points on the, you know, on the IPSS, and now you actually look to, and that's not the same as a patient who has a platelet count of two. And I think that that was a major change in the scoring systems that I think clinically seems to make a lot of sense.
Yes, that's what the consensus of the group was, and it's one of the reasons that we decided to look more carefully at those features. One of the things to be aware of is age and some of the other predictors are valuable for survival, but not for AML evolution. This just shows the survival curves and freedom from AML evolution curves for the five subgroups of patients with the IPSSR. This is a patient that would be worth discussing to help understand how these scoring systems work and how useful they might be. 58-year-old woman with fatigue and anemia. She has moderate anemia of 9.2 hemoglobin, macrocytosis, a low white count with a normal differential, platelet count of 100,000, and a low retic count of 2%. Serum erythropoietin level is 30. B12 is normal, as is creatinine. A serum ferritin is 500. The importance of the ferritin is to have people aware that we're not dealing with an anemia related to iron deficiency, and also to be aware that ferritin can be elevated in the presence of an illness that has not yet been transfused, a patient with it has not yet been transfused, suggesting that the ferritin level may be an acute phase reactant related to some degree of inflammation. The serum EPO level is important because although it is higher than normal, it is certainly suboptimal for the degree of anemia that the patient has. So we have a patient with a hypoproductive anemia and a low serum EPO level, despite a creatinine that is normal. The B12 level being normal is important because that and folate are, of course, reasons that patients can have macrocytosis. So a bone marrow was done, which was normocellular, showed a normal M to E ratio of 2:1, trilane edge dysplasia, and 3% blasts, normal iron and no ring sideroblasts. Cytogenetics were abnormal and showed trisomy 8. Now the ME ratio of 2:1 is interesting because in someone that's anemic, you'd expect a reversal of that. You'd like to see erythroid hyperplasia, but actually you don't. So there's something suboptimal here that goes along with the patient having a hypoproductive anemia. Trilineage dysplasia is important and a low percentage of blasts. And so if one looks at these characteristics, that is the cytopenias and their depth, the cytogenetics and the proportion of blasts, one can then come up with a diagnosis and prognostic risk category. As you can see, based on the old FAB classification, this would be considered refractory anemia, whereas the WHO classification would be considering this as refractory cytopenia with multilineage dysplasia. The prognostic risk category would be intermediate 1 by the IPSS, intermediate by the IPSS-R, and that associated with the patient's age. And so for management of this patient, one would consider this patient relatively low risk, and the first stage of management would be to try for hematologic improvement for this patient's anemia, since they have a suboptimal level of erythropoietin. The use of an erythropoietic stimulating agent would be the first step here. And then we have a second patient who's quite different. It's a 65-year-old man with fatigue and anemia, but in addition to his hemoglobin being 9.2 with macrocytosis, has a lower white count, a lower platelet count of 40,000, still low retics. He now is red cell transfusion dependent. He's begun taking red cells to diminish his fatigue. He has received erythropoietin, but has been unresponsive to that. His serum erythropoietin level is quite high at 300. B12 is high and normal, and creatinine ferritin. Creatinine is normal and the ferritin is elevated, the latter possibly related to the transfusions that he's recently had. The bone marrow is, again, hypercellular with a ME ratio of 2:1. Again, trilineage dysplasia, but now it's got 9% blasts with normal iron, no ring sideroblasts, and monosomy 7. So here what we're seeing is pancytopenia, which is more severe than the prior patient, a blast count that is somewhat elevated compared to the prior patient, and a monosomy 7, which is a poor risk cytogenetic feature. And as a result, the classification of this patient will be different than the first patient. And morphologically, you can look here and see that this patient by FAB would be refractory anemia with excess blasts, but by WHO, it would be RAB 2. As a matter of fact, this patient in 9% blasts, in fact, would still be RAB 1. But despite that, his prognostic risk category would be intermediate 2 by IPSS, but very high by IPSR and the IPSS-RA related to age. And that difference is not huge because in both cases, the patient would be considered higher risk and the management of this patient would be to try to alter the natural history, potential evolution to acute leukemia, and as a result, a hypomethylating agent probably would be the next agent to be used here.
But I think that when you look at the projected survivals, if you don't treat the patient, in the first case where you have basically a modest anemia and really no other blasts, no other cytopenias, no cytogenetic problems, that's a fairly low-risk patient, should have a 3+, maybe 5-year survival under both scoring systems. In your second case, you do see a split here between the patient being IPSS 2, intermediate 2 in the old system, and high and very high in the newer system, which actually puts your survival, if you're not aggressive in treating the patient, different between the two categories. I think because the patient has worsening cytopenias, higher blast percentages, and a very bad cytogenetics. So there is a split between the two scoring systems.
That's right, and that's why I think that the IPSR is more refined and gives you more precise prognostic information, and as a result, would push you much more clearly to giving the patient therapy to alter the natural history of the disease.
Do you have a sense of how many times, if you did the score on both systems, that you'd get this sort of split?
Yes, that's been looked at, and it predominantly occurs in the intermediate group. So that in patients that previously had been either intermediate 1 or intermediate 2 in the IPSS, about 20% of those patients would be reclassified into either higher or lower categories, depending on these features.
So basically, the goods do good, the bads do bad, and it's the middle group where the IPSSR really helps you determine if they're going to be a good or a bad.
That's correct, yes.
Does it often change what you're going to do? Because here you, with IPSS intermediate 2, hypomethylating agents would be the standard of care under the NCCN guidelines. The AZA-001 trial would say that all these patients essentially should be treated with a hypomethylator. In that middle group, do you have a sense of how many times it would push you to doing treatment when you may not have thought about treatment before?
Probably in about 20% of patients, this will occur. And so, generally, one would opt for management to change the natural history, which would either be hypomethylating agent, or if the patient is eligible, to try for a transplant, a bone marrow transplant, with bridging of the situation from the patient currently with a hypomethylating agent. So for the management, this is pretty much what we've just talked about. We consider clinically relevant cytopenias, not just what their cytopenias are, age, performance status, the risk categories, stem cell transplant, whether they're a candidate or not. The issue about whether they're a transplant candidate depends on what their risk category is, their age, performance status, and if there's a donor. This just gives you a rough idea of management strategies, and that is those patients in blue are lower risk, and those patients in red are higher risk. The lower risk category that have Del5q, lenalidomide has been shown to be quite important. Maybe 60 or 70% of those patients will be responsive. Those patients that have ring sideroblasts, often in addition to erythropoietin, require G-CSF as a synergistic agent. There is a subgroup of younger patients with MDS, normal cytogenetics, may have hypocellular marrows, that may have HLA-DR15, HLA typing, and those patients may be responsive to immunosuppression with ATG and cyclosporine. That's a group that one needs to be well aware of. If these patients don't respond to such therapies, clinical trials are often important, and this is beyond erythropoietin given for nearly all of the individuals who are anemic and have relatively low EPO levels. In red, you can see the higher risk patients, and as we've talked about, hypomethylating agents would be the standard of care, and those in hatched bars that are relatively younger would be eligible for transplant, and that's what we aim for in a high proportion of these patients that are in higher risk. This gives you some data regarding what you had mentioned about the AZA-001 trial, which is azacitidine versus conventional care. And as you can see, in these higher risk patients, the median of 24 months versus 15 months was found, and now that's the standard of care. Decitabine can give you roughly similar data, but there are no phase 3 data that will support that. But certainly retrospective data and phase 2 trials have shown similarity to azacitidine. This just shows you that those patients that undergo allogeneic transplant can be predicted as to how their outcomes will be based on the IPSS-R, showing you that those patients in lower risk do much better than those in higher risk, although there is a portion of patients in higher risk that still have long-term survival. And these curves are those that have been developed by John Corath and colleagues, in which one would look at whether or not one should consider in older individuals transplant versus a hypomethylating agent or the other types of care. And what was determined was that in lower risk patients, it's shown that in yellow, those individuals who got standard care did better than if they were transplanted early. On the other hand, higher risk patients, it appears that one can do better by transplanting at that point in time rather than conventional care. So our aim is, as I've mentioned, using agents for hematologic improvement in lower risk and higher risk patients to undergo transplant or more intensive therapy.
So this data sort of mimics what Corey Cutler published maybe a decade ago with conventional transplant before the reduced intensity, that for the lower risk patient it was better to give them low risk therapies until they started showed signs of progression, and then the higher risk patient it was better to probably move quicker to the transplant at that point.
Exactly. This is, in fact, using the same system as Dr. Cutler had previously done for the IPSS.
One of the questions in actually a consult I did last week was a younger patient who had intermediate two disease, or he could have had actually high risk, but in our patient was intermediate two, whether we should try to cytoreduce him prior to bringing him to transplant. Should we just take him right to transplant? Should we give him AML type therapy, or should we give him a couple cycles of a hypomethylating agent while they're trying to find the donor?
That's an important question, but unfortunately, there are very few good answers, in that there are no trials that have indicated clearly which approach one should use. I think that many centers base their approach on outcomes that depend on the portion of blasts that were present at the time of transplant. And therefore, if one does that, the idea would be to try to cytoreduce these individuals, decrease the blast count prior to transplant. One can do that either with induction therapy, which has a bit of a risk, or with a hypomethylating agent. But generally, one or the other of those is done, and with standard conditioning to move that down to less than 10% blasts. But if one is using non-myeloablative conditioning, less than 5% blasts prior to transplant.
I think that's an important point. As an ex-transplanter, I know that, the reduced intensity, we see much higher relapses, although we have less toxicity. So it ends up coming out this, you end up getting the same survival down the road, because you have more relapses. But I think that as if I were seeing a patient who had a little bit higher blast percentages and I was going to do a reduced intensity, I would want to see maybe another cycle of Dacogen, another cycle of 5-azacitidine to try to bring that blast percentage a little bit lower prior to the transplant.
Yes, I agree, and I think some of the data do support that point. And so one of the other issues that we now face is this is a heterogeneous disease. Some of the issues are captured by the clinical karyotyping and clinical evaluation I've mentioned. But in addition, now there's a change in understanding the disease based on mutations. And these mutations within the bone marrow cells are present in about 90% of patients that will have at least one mutation. Four to six of them may be consistent, but they're only present in about 10% of patients. There may be a large number, up to 100 genes, that are frequently mutated, but at least 25 genes appear to have prognostic import. And those are things that one needs to be well aware of. Often one finds that there are one to two to three driver genes abnormal to begin with, and that number increases with clonal evolution. Occasionally, there can be genotype-phenotype associations, such as patients with the gene mutation SF3B1 will have ring sideroblasts, whereas patients with TET2 and SRSF2 may have CMML. This slide just shows the issue of which genes have prognostic import. And as you can see by those in yellow, those five genes, RUNX1, ETV6, TP53, ASXL1, EZH2, have been reproduced in three or four studies to be of very poor prognostic importance. The others have been reported, but in a lower number of studies. Of great importance is the fact that one group of gene mutations are those from the spliceosome, and there are eight genes from the spliceosome that have been abnormal in MDS and are relatively critical for understanding this disease.
Peter, I think that one of the things that maybe our readers might not understand is that, these genes can be found in the peripheral blood. That whereas we talked about the importance of bone marrow to get classical karyotyping, you can go back and say, "Wow, I found MDS, and I didn't get this information when I did the bone marrow." That the blood that's made by an MDS patient will harbor these genes, and you can do that with most of the commercial labs, do this panel off of old-fashioned peripheral blood.
Yes, that's right. So that one certainly could do that, and that could be quite useful. So the question comes up about testing for these recurrently mutated genes. Important is to realize it should be considered in the appropriate clinical context. It can establish clonal hematopoiesis, which is somatic, and often one wants to be sure it's not germline. Germline would be, for example, from buccal smears, or if one had skin tissue or other normal tissue to evaluate to be sure that this is in the hematopoietic cell line. But one needs to be clear that these abnormalities are not diagnostic of MDS without other morphologic and perhaps cytogenetic criteria, because some of these mutations can be age-related. Once one reaches the age of 60 or 70, where most of the patients that we see with MDS are, there can be mutations that occur in individuals that lack the specific diagnosis. There's no mutation that's specific for MDS. As I mentioned just now, it could be age-related, and not all MDS patients have MDS mutations. But one thing that is relatively clear, that if the diagnosis is substantiated morphologically or cytogenetically, these specific mutations appear to aid prognostication. There's a large group effort now being looked at to see whether or not one can establish this more precisely, not just for the five genes or the 25 genes that I've mentioned, but for all of them. And there is in this group, the International Working Group for Prognosis in MDS, the molecular committee of that is now working to try to establish that point.
I've heard that for if you have a patient who has one of those five genes, that essentially their outcome is essentially one point up on the IPSS score. So if they were an intermediate two, they moved to high risk. If they were an intermediate one, they moved to an intermediate two. And that's one way to use that gene in combination with the IPSS. Is that how you use it?
Yes, there are data that would support that for certain genes. Not all of the genes that I had shown you have been evaluated in that way, but three or four of them have. What hasn't been looked at is what happens with combinations, particularly if you have a combination of a good and a bad gene. Some of the gene abnormalities, mutations, have good prognosis, or others have poor prognosis. So one needs to take that into consideration. In addition, prognosis also depends on the number of mutations. So the more mutations one has, the worse prognosis. So I think that over the next few years, we'll be more precise about that. But certainly one needs to be aware that if you have those genes, it can move you into a worse prognostic grouping.
Do any of the genes specifically tell you a particular chemotherapy to use?
There are several gene abnormalities, such as TET2 abnormalities, that are present in patients who may be more responsive to hypomethylating agents. And so that is something to consider, but it's not all inclusive because there are patients that lack that that do respond. One important point about that, though, is that in patients with 5q minus abnormalities, not all respond to lenalidomide, and it turns out that a high proportion of those that don't respond have TP53 mutations, and those individuals have a very poor prognosis. So evaluating those that gene mutation in non-responders is important for understanding next steps for therapy. And so finally, how do we individualize a patient for therapeutic decisions in MDS? One is to be sure that you first of all establish the diagnosis morphologically. This can be difficult. There are subtleties that occur in evaluating the degree of dysplasia that occurs within marrow and peripheral blood. And certainly that is an important component and often not easy. One wants to understand that these patients have symptomatic cytopenias that may require some degree of intervention. And then to establish the prognostic risk category, as I've mentioned, blood counts, marrow blasts, cytogenetics, age and performance status are important. And the future role of these specific gene mutations, which I've mentioned, will play a large role in our decisions. So the treatment then would be lower versus higher risk disease, lower risk to try to have hematologic improvement, higher risk disease change the natural history. Biospecific therapy, hematopoietic stem cell transplant are the agents that we're currently using, but one hopes that with the mutational studies that we can become even more specific in our ability to manage these patients. So I hope I've given you a broad overview of where we are with classification of MDS patients as well as approaches to their therapy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Greenberg. I think that's a wonderful review of where we've come from, just looking at morphology to utilizing cytogenetics and now moving into a molecular mechanisms of maybe a little bit of the disease, but also how moleculars can change our prognosis and the way we think, and how all of this can be used to help us select medications, or at least select a general strategy, whether we're going to be conservative or whether we need to consider being more aggressive. I think that P53 statement, I heard Dr. Raza give a talk recently. As you know, she's been a pioneer in 5q minus disease, and she said that, you know, when she sees a P53, she takes that patient out of the low risk category and moves them into the higher risk and starts even talking to them about transplant. So I think that we're going to refine these prognostic forms even more. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed this. I'm Dr. Stuart Goldberg with Dr. Peter Greenberg for managingmds.com. Please check out the website. There are many other seminars on this topic, and hopefully you can help get your patients a little bit better therapy by refining it, utilizing the IPSS-R. Thanks very much.